Yeah, thank you for these nice words. I think during this meeting, we have seen that there is a lot of interesting and exciting science if you talk about the interaction of relativistic electrons with strong photon beams. You know, the FEL is one thing which comes out of this, and then we learned also today that whatever you produce, you have to transport this with beamlines and optics to the sample. But talking about the sample, I think things changed a lot. We will probably no longer talk about a sample which you put on the place of the diffractometer and it stays there forever. You probably have particles coming, flying across the beam. And so I think if you want to study and to find out, you know, what are the conditions for your experiment to be successful, we have to learn and we have to start talking about luminosity, which tells you something about the probability that your photon flash will hit the target particle you're interested in. Okay, then it also became clear that you have to characterize the FEL beam, but I think this is also true for the particles, for the sample. You better know what you have. And then, as we heard this morning, detectors and data processing are things which are of key importance. And because in most cases, we will no longer be interested only in ground state properties, we talk about pump lasers, pump and probe experiments for synchronization, all the measurement of jitter is of great importance. If you look what we learned at this meeting, here it is, you see, this is the spectral distribution shot by shot as we see it at the flash facility. You remember, we have seen a lot of simulation calculations about H, G, and G, and you know, there was the hope that these pulses are very, very nice and regular. Things seem to be more difficult, but if you look at what has been achieved on the SASE, this is quite encouraging because these pulses, you know, in the peak have two energies of 200 microjoule, in the average 100, pulse duration about 10 femtoseconds, energy resolution 0.5%, peak powers above 4 gigawatt. So I think this is certainly something, and as you have seen from Mikhail's talk in the beginning of the meeting, we really meet the expectation, and that's very important, you know, if we talk about the hard X-ray facilities, then because so far we just rely on what has been calculated. The other point I want to make is there is this line here that flash has two lines. One is the one where you look at the facility the way we have it now, and then the other one which is the seeded version of it. Okay, couldn't find it, what that means. Now he is. So there was some discussion about seeding, I think almost every day. So this is what we call the self-seeding, where we, you know, hope to get very nice pulses with a very high, you know, with a couple of millievolts energy resolution, and we pay for this. The pulses are longer. We are no longer talking about 10 femtosecond pulses. So the idea is, whoop, where is it here? The idea is to go here, you know, with your electron bunch into a first undulator, which brings you in the gain curve maybe up to 2/3 of saturation. Then you bring this pulse, which the SASE pulse, to a monochromator, and this monochromator is about with a resolution of 50,000. The electron beam goes through a bypass here, loses all the sort of structuring and is fresh more or less here, and then it's seeded by the photon pulse which was coming out of the monochromator. So that is something which is under construction. It's currently tested at Aarhus University. We are still waiting for the third harmonic cavity for flash, which is needed. Now, if you now take the long pulse, then you don't have just, this is 200 femtoseconds something, so you have this, the typical spiky structure, and what you expect, what you hope for, is that, you have very nice energy resolution and pulses which are about two orders of magnitude higher in spectral brilliance. Okay. We will have fluctuations in intensity, and I think this is true for whatever we are talking about. None of our machines are working like a clock. We are not working in equilibrium conditions as the people in a storage ring do. We are just looking shot by shot, and I think in order to be sure to know what we are doing, we have to characterize the beam shot by shot. And for sure, we have intensity fluctuations, as you heard from Matthias Richter, we can measure it. And this is an example where people looked at the resonant two photon absorption in helium. And then you see, depending on the intensity of your incident beam, the photoelectron spectrum which you get, the number of electrons is definitely changing. And then if you look at this little bump here, then you see if the intensity is low, this bump doesn't exist at all. So then if you plot the intensity, the integrated intensity of this photoelectron peak, you see that as a function of the pulse energy, you see this is definitely, the intensity is not going linearly, it's a non-linear process, and it's a nice example of what is coming down the road. We think it's non-sequential resonant two-photon absorption, but I think the people are still studying it. Now, if you want to bring the photon beam to the sample, then we have to think about mirrors. You heard about this morning, and you look for materials. So what the people did here is you have a mirror, and you do some reflection of optical light, and then you fire with a laser beam on top, and then you take a movie of optical pictures, and you measure the reflectivity, and this way you see how, let's say, the material changes with time. So for a physicist, the most interesting thing is what we don't see. Is a certainly a phase transition, an electronically driven phase transition from solid to liquid, which somehow happens between 0 picosecond and 10 picoseconds. But even then, you see, there's a lot of interesting things to be looked at. People do this currently, look in much detail, they do spectroscopy, and you see, for sure, there are lots of differences between, sort of ablation experiments if you go to the VOV spectral range or if you go to the optical laser, which we know about. So this is part of the game that, if you want to have mirrors, I think it's good and important to think about material. Now, coming to applications, once you have the beam on the experimental port, so these are, let's say, examples from the group around, of Joachim Ulrich at the Max Planck Institute for Kernphysik in Heidelberg. And they are making a big effort. They have three programs. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about this, the results on the highly charged ions. Now, what is interesting with highly charged ions? They play an essential role in high-temperature plasma on, let's say, where we are on the Earth, but I think they are also abundant in the cosmos, and they provide us with unique information about the composition and the state of matter of even the most distant known objects. But we have to learn, we have to understand these molecules, and in addition, I think there is something exciting. We already know this from synchrotron radiation work. Very nicely, it's very often so that you can combine basic questions, fundamental questions, with things which are close to application. And here, if you want to characterize a plasma as something which is closer to application than probing quantum electrodynamics, but you can do it, and this is exciting. So what these people do, they're interested to measure the energy level of the splitting. And then you see to this splitting, there's a contribution from quantum electrodynamics. There are calculations, but it's difficult to calculate. And you have to have a spectrometer with a very high accuracy in order to be useful. So what they get today is about 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4. And what we feel and what they have shown, you can get much better at flash. But then what they tell us, you know, not only that we have to have a lot of photons in one flash to get the signal out, we also need statistics. So for them, they say, we need the high peak brilliance for such a spectrometer and a high average brilliance. Okay, if it comes to average brilliance, you have seen these plots. You know, this is what we have at the best possible storage rings these days. And this is what we have at flash today. That's what we hope to have. And this is what the European XFAL facility will give you. And you see there are orders of magnitudes above what we have today from storage rings. And I think it's needed. It's needed if you think about experiments in this language of luminosity. You have to have, you have to give your system a chance, you know, that the flash meets the target. And here you have this example, you know, where they create or prepare these, it is iron 23 plus, in an electron beam ion track without going into the details. The point I want to make is you don't have very many of these iron 23 plus, and you have to get your signal out. And it's complicated. So you do coincidence measurements. You have many different types of detectors of various kind of resolution involved. But once you have it, when you can handle it, you get what you want. And these people had quite a number of days, shifts of beam time. Finally, you see the data they measured was in about 2,000 seconds. And that's the fluorescent signal which they were after. And that was done at flash at a time when the power in the beam and the performance wasn't that good as it is today. So we are sure that these people will be certainly one of our very happy users in the months to come. Now, when we talk about samples, these are ions. So if you think about the science, you have the photons, and you have your target. And now what sort of targets we may be interested in? Why? We're certainly not only interested in atoms. You may be interested in molecules. And one way that people have suggested, you know, you can start with a molecular beam from a nozzle. You can put it in an inhomogeneous electric field where the gradient helps you to align the molecule. And then, you know, you have to slow it down, which they do in a dark, in a stark decelerator, and then you go in a trap. So, and once you are in the trap, you can keep these particles, and you can keep them in a rather aligned way. And that's a dream. You know, it's not easy. This is what you may get if you don't do anything in addition to what I've explained, but if you have a guiding field in addition, then the hope is that you can really orient the molecules. Not only you know that they have the line, you also know where it's up and where it's down. So this is something that has been proposed and is being done here in Berlin at the Fritz Haber Institute. I think you will get these view graphs and the references, but I think this is part of the element that we will merge techniques which haven't been together for in the past, but it will be very important in the future to get not only the photons, but to get the samples you're interested in. Now, many of you have seen this. This is one of these dream experiments for the hot X-rays, to take an image in a single shot from a molecule instead of going to crystals where, you know, you have to put them all together. It is difficult for many of these, of the most interesting ones. So you want to get this picture. But again, you have to have your molecules somehow. You know, you may have a molecule in a nano droplet falling down somehow, and you have to meet the guy. And so there's a lot of thinking to prepare samples. And here's another way that people say, you know, we would like, we will not be able to get a full picture with one shot. Doesn't work. So we have to do something like tomography. We have to, you know, play with many pictures. But then we need the orientation. The minimum information which you need to get with one shot is the orientation. But if you cannot pre-align your sample, that helps an awful lot, reduces the amount of data you need. And then the other point that, you know, this is more what the physicists, you know, can think of. If you talk to the chemists, to biochemists, you know, they have lots of ideas. Why are you not having a virus and then you put the sample we were interested in at definite places of the virus and try to get the information by taking pictures of this monster molecule? I don't know if this will work, but it just indicates, you know, the line, the thing that people have to do in order to be successful with these new sources. Okay. When you have the goal to get a single, you know, sort of a single shot picture of a molecule, if it's let's say, a molecule of biological interest, and you put all these photons in, which you have to do in order to get the signal out of background, then these molecules will explode, we know that. So it's important to understand this process. What happens? And there's, you know, one approach that if you look at clusters, you have a sort of a transition between single atoms and a solid, and that's done by many people, and the group around Thomas Müller has been doing this with flesh. And you see somehow the type of questions the people ask. And I think these are all questions not only of importance for clusters, I think they are important if you want to understand the interaction of the photon beams we are going to produce with the samples we are interested in. Okay, so that's now the experiment. And you have the FEL beam. We have been talking a lot about the FEL beam. We have to characterize the beam, then you have to focus the beam. You have mirrors. These mirrors have to stay in the beam. They do. You know, this was very important to find out that this mirror focusing down to 20 micron diameter has been in the beam all the time. Then you prepare your clusters, and then you have a whole zoo of different types of detectors. And now you come to this point that Heinz Grafsmann had this morning. We get shot by shot a lot of data. And the people at some stage, you know, will go home and have this multi-parameter space, and they will probe their ideas by making cuts through the multi-parameter space and find out if this fits or not. This is an approach well known in nuclear physics, in particle physics, and I think that our field will make use of this experience. So what do they see? With one shot, you get this time of flight spectrum from the ions. I think this is known here. We get about as many photons in 50 femtoseconds from flesh as we get today per second. And this is exciting. You know, this just gives you the possibility to look at structure not only on the right scale in space, but also on the right scale in time. And that's the new element which is coming up in these things. So the picture, if you look at the numbers, they come up and say, you know, if you have 100 nanometer photons coming in on the cluster, so, you know, the pulse is ramping up, has a maximum, is slowing down again. So in the beginning, you will ionize the cluster, some electrons, the potential is going deeper, you get more electrons, deeper potential, it still keeps together, at some stage it will explode. So the point is here that if it comes to 100 nanometer, they observe about absorption of about 40 photons per atom, and this is due to this microplasma. But now they did the same experiments at 32 nanometer, and then it's down to, you know, normal, 0.2 photons per atom. So for sure, it will be very exciting to find out what happens between 100 nanometer and 32 nanometer, and to see what this process is and how it disappears. The next thing, as I said, if you have a cluster, you better know what this damn thing is. And so far, the people only know from thermodynamic arguments what is the size of the cluster. And so what Möller's group has done, they have taken pictures. You know, these clusters are of the size of nanometers, and so you should get diffraction pattern from a cluster. So they have the FEL beam on their cluster somehow. They get a scattering picture. They have cesium iodide photocathode and multi-channel plate detector, bring it with a mirror to the CCD camera. I think everybody doing experiments will be very keen to get this direct beam never hitting anything close to where you do your measurements. And then they measure, and that's what they get. This is a small angle scattering picture of a cluster with a single shot. And you can do this quantitatively. And the point they find is, the first thing, you know, what they measure is twice as large as what they thought. In addition, from these time of flight measurements they have done, you know how much do these ions, do these atoms move in the duration of the pulse of 20, 30 femtoseconds, and it's about 3 angstrom. So for our resolution in these experiments, when you work with 32 nanometer, I think this system is stable, and that's the size, the scattering pattern from which you can determine the size. Point is that this signal is so strong that you know you get it even if you attenuate the beam down to 1% or less. And this means that you will be able to do the same sort of measurements also with third harmonic, because third harmonic is about 0.5% of the fundamental. And this opens the door for nice pump and probe experiments where you not only want to see the cluster as it is coming out of the nozzle, but you want to see how it develops in time, exploding, and hopefully to understand all these things better. Okay, now from clusters, solids, single shot photo emission is another one of the dreams, and if you do that, you get some exciting results, depending on the power of your incident beam. You know, if you have the power of the incident beam relatively low, you get a photoelectron peak, which is very close to what you expect. If the power gets higher, you know, this thing is shifted, it's getting asymmetric. This is also expected. But if you go to even higher, it's gone. It's space charge. Now, I think this figure here is a nightmare for a guy from condensed matter physics who wants to do ground state or, you know, photo emission spectroscopy. This is, you know, you don't want that. But then you go to see other people, you know, interested in extreme states of matter, and then they say, oh, wow, this is interesting. You know, imagine you flood your solid with electrons. What a system is this? Okay, so now either a nightmare or exciting. In any case, if you go and work with solids, space charge effects are very important. And therefore, I think people, as we have heard in one of the talks, you will not only do photo emission, but you will also do photon in, photon out spectroscopy to understand these things better. And also, I have to say, you know, this is a system to do, you know, copper as the 3D elements. It has a very, very high cross section. So, you know, this is, you find systems where the trouble isn't that big. But it gives us a warning. Okay, so that's solids. And I think this is the end with the examples. Being close to a synchrotron radiation facility and our community, which we have today, the point we have to make here is that doing experiments at the laser is completely different from what the people do at storage rings today. They come, they have their sample, they know the machine works like a clock, and they don't care They don't care. They don't want to know where these photons come from and why they are so nice. They use them. I think if you do an experiment at an FEL, the experiment starts at the injector, where the time structure and all these things are determined. And then you go through the LINAC, and then you talk about the FEL process, and we have heard a lot of things which you can do. And then, the sample. I emphasize this fact that the sample is a key element if you want to do science and detectors. So this is a whole thing. And we know that down the road, there are very many things we have to learn. The process, the FEL process itself, the diagnostics. Mechanical stability is interesting. It's 3 micrometers, 10 femtoseconds. And we talk about beam paths of 2 meter, 3 meter, I don't know. Then to understand the interaction processes of the FEL beam with matter, sample preparation, sample environment, detectors, data processing. So taking this into account, I think we are very fortunate due to the fact that we have a sort of almost continuous development in facilities, and I concentrate here only on the hard spectral part. We know there are lots of things going on in the soft X-ray regime, I think we should collaborate, and we should really make sure that you can learn on whatever machine is available as soon as possible, which will then be of great value for the machines coming after this. Now, I think we have two very strong communities if it comes to applications, the laser people and the synchrotron people. And those who will do X-ray experiments at FELs, I think they somehow will combine the experience of the two fields. And if you have, the combination of two very successful fields of research, I think there is new science and innovations down the road. And I'm convinced that a lot of what we are going to do, for sure, we need accelerator science. That's what we have learned here. But I think we also need a new type of approach, do the experiments, and maybe it's very close to particle physics methodology. And so let me just finish by showing this picture again. There are lots of things that have to go together in order to be successful in doing science at free electron lasers. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jochen, for the fascinating talk on an exciting, broad field of science. There are surely questions, comments. Alan.
This reminds me very much of 1990 when we started to do vibrational infrared experiments. And Dana DeLotte came to me and he said, you have to realize that an FEL is not an experiment. And in reality, when we looked at the investment for equipment and the investment in time that went into our FEL and our facilities for doing experiments, at least as much money was spent on the experiments. And so my question is, what is the status of expenditure of effort and money at the present time in these VUV and X-ray facilities? Is there sufficient money being expended on the development of the experimental facilities? Because they are certainly critically important, as your talk has illustrated.
I think it certainly it depends very much to whom you talk and to what country you go. I must say that I'm very, very happy about the situation we have in Germany, where it's just been decided that we will create a center for free electron laser studies at the DESY site as a cooperation between the Max Planck Society, DESY, and the University of Hamburg, where we just advertised to have four what we call full professorships and strong groups, and I think there the people in the Max Planck Society, in the Helmholtz Association, at the city of Hamburg, and also in the Federal Republic, they somehow got the point that spending you know, for the XFL, $1 billion. You better make sure that your community is prepared. And you don't get the community prepared by this normal type of contracts, you know, 2 years, 3 years. These are very risky things, and you have to have a long breath. This is something for long-distance runners, and not just for those who get 100 meter and that's it. And I think in Germany that worked out very well. In other countries, I know it's much more difficult, and also what I hear from the United States, it's not obvious. There's a sort of tendency that these agencies like to build machines, and then they may a little bit forget that you have to do something with these machines. But I think the XFAL and the needs are so obvious that I don't think that people are stupid. So they will spend money to get experiments being prepared.
Over there.
Is it fair to say that with regard to the cluster experiments, that we can learn a lot in comparing FEL experiments with conventional infrared laser experiments because the photon energies are so different and the nature of the ionizations are quite different, even though the Coulomb explosion is the end result in both cases?
Yeah. No, I think it's a very good example for exactly this. It's, you know, it's just, that's what I mean when I say, you know, we have the laser community together. It's not just XFEL or VOVFEL. I think it's, there's a whole whole zoo of tools, and it's very nice to see that the people from the different fields are here and talk to each other. That's needed. And I think the science will be exciting by combining.
Well, we have time for one more question. It's all the way in the back. Ah, smaller.
So, good morning. Among the three major good properties of the XFL, that is a peak power and very short pulse, and there is another good property, the coherency. Have you heard of the application of the make use of this coherency?
No, I think if you think about this imaging technique, you need, if you want to get pictures, you know, not from the, if you do small angle scattering on the cluster, you don't need a coherent beam. I think there is something, you know, we will also barely have a fully coherent beam. We will have a partially coherent beam, which is an interesting theoretical exercise. And if you think about taking pictures of nano-sized particles, I think you really need the coherence. And then, in our place, people are very interested in this photocorrelation spectroscopy. Again, it's not trivial, you know, to get a coherent beam on your sample. But if you look at what is available in this, you know, you have a diagram where you look at energy and momentum transfer and you look at what sort of excitations you can reach. I think the photon correlation spectroscopy opens an area which is dark so far. And the people who used to do neutron scattering, I think they are excited. The photon people get into this slowly. That depends on whom you talk. But there are some neutron guys I know that they get excited. I think these are the two things at the moment, the coherence and the imaging, and then we have to learn. There are more ideas around, but they are very sort of loose.
Well, let's thank our speaker again. Thank you, Jochen.